Welcome to episode 33 of the Active Photographer Podcast, your behind-the-scenes glimpse into the day-to-day life of a working professional photographer, with me, Giles Babbage. This week's show sees another return to the office of photographer and writer Hugh Graham, who, as a lot of you will know, was one of my lecturers when I studied at university. It seems you all seem to like our frank and lively conversations, and on this occasion, we're talking about the matter of the role technology plays in the lives of us photographers. A lot has changed within photography over the years, of course. Film technology, the digital revolution, even the manufacture of lenses. But has it really made that much difference to the way we shoot and the imagery we produce? At a particular point in our conversation, you'll hear me mention the pioneering photographer Julia Margaret Cameron. Now, the audio that I allude to was actually recorded at Dimbola Lodge, her one-time home, and it was featured way back in episode 18 of The Active Photographer. So let's get the debate going. Welcome, one and all, to The Active Photographer, episode 33. So I'm with Hugh Graham again, and today we're going to be talking about technology in terms of photography, how it's progressed over the years, and more importantly, the difference that it makes to our working lives as photographers, or for anyone that's taking a picture or not. There's the old cliche that, you know, it's only tools, and technology can only take you so far before you actually have to realise that you need the skills and a basic understanding. That's where we're going to start. What's your opening gambit on this, Hugh?
When I started to work on the Hemel Hempstead Gazette in the early 50s, the staff photographers there were using 5x4 speed graphics, and they were using flash guns that fired actual flash bulbs. These guys used to load their own dark 5x4 slides with film. And in those days, there were photographers and there were printers. The photographer just shot the picture. The printer, working in the newspaper darkroom, was responsible for doing all the printing. Whereas leaping forward rapidly to the present day, I think most photographers now will be shooting digitally, and they will be processing the image in Photoshop. So in a sense, they are far more in control of the final image today than they were 50 years ago.
So that, I mean, that's immediately made me think of the thing that, especially when digital was kind of the new thing and people are becoming more aware of it, people would, I know personally, and I'm sure it's been the same with you, people would say, oh, you must be so glad now with this digital, you can see your picture and it's so immediate and all the rest of it. Well, whereas before you'd shoot maybe 8 rolls of film, throw it at your processing labs, and a week or so later, whatever, your proofs come back and that's your process. All of a sudden, you either pay someone to do all your Photoshop work or you bring it in-house and you have to take care of it. So in some sense, it's a double-edged sword, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. But then, I suppose the great joy, when I made the jump from 35mm Minoltas to digital Canons, the great joy for me was the screen on the back of the camera, which allowed me to see that I'd actually got a picture, that the shutter hadn't jammed, that the transport mechanism hadn't failed, that I was actually getting images. And that was a huge relief, because in those days, The stock phrase for any photographer, regardless of how competent he was, okay, let's see if the pictures are all right. And there was a huge relief. And you probably remember this as well, John. There's a huge relief of actually seeing images on the film when you were working in the darkroom.
And certainly in a monetary sense, wasn't it a Polaroid? If you were to use a Polaroid back on a Mamiya studio camera, you're looking at least a pound per shot.
Yes.
And that was as close as you could get. So the other argument was, well, digital, you pay for your camera and you've got your lenses and you've got your memory cards. the once you've paid for that, your quid's in because there's not the expense. Now, there's obviously the outlay in the first instance.
But I think that I don't think that's a fair comparison, Giles, because cameras are actually a great deal cheaper than they were 20 years ago. I can remember paying for my Minolta's nearly 900 quid for a camera body, and you can certainly get a really good Canon body for not much more than that now.
But is that due to the phenomenal rate at which consumer electronics is pushing the prices further down, but the technology is progressing further up and along?
Yes, I think that's true. And we're about to move into another area. I'm not sure. How often do you change your camera bodies?
As regular listeners will know, I'm not one of these people that changes a body just because a new one comes out. So it's, for me personally, probably, assuming the cameras last long enough, probably 2 to 3 years maybe.
Okay. Well, you use a full frame Nikon, don't you?
Yeah.
And I use a crop frame Canon.
Mm.
And the reason I use a crop frame Canon is because I have fallen in love with Canon 17-55 EFS 2.8 image stabilized lens. It is, in my view, and only my view probably, the best lens that Canon ever produced. It's not an L series lens, but it's superb. And I won't contemplate a full frame camera because of this particular piece of glass. It's absolutely staggering. And I'm sure other photographers have similar love stories. Do you have a favorite lens?
I have two favourite lenses which equally are not the top of the line Nikon lenses. One of them is the 50mm f1.8, which is kind of the poor relation in some regards because there's a 1.4, so an extra third of a stop. Are you going to see the difference?
Oh, really important.
You know, really important. But that is razor sharp. Now that is... that essentially is...
Hang on, which is razor sharp, the 1.4 or the 1.8?
Well, my 1.8 is, okay, and I haven't personally tried the 1.4.
Yeah.
Now, that's on my full frame is fine. It works, there's no vignetting in the corners, what have you. My other favourite lens, which I got before, when I was shooting on a D200, which was a DX sensor, so it's a crop.
Yeah.
This particular lens is a 35mm... 1.4, I think it is. Could be a 1.8, but I think it's a 1.4. That equally is fantastically sharp, but on the full frame camera, the D3 series, that actually has a vignette in it, or it actually the automatic cropping kicks in when you attach that lens. So yes, you can, because of the sensor size on that particular camera, you can shoot still on it, knowing that you're going to be cropping in slightly to take the central portion. Okay. But I remember going back.
But your 50mm 1.4 on the D200.
Yeah.
Would have been what, 75, 80?
Yeah, because of the markup.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, it's all.
Which would turn it into a sort of semi-telephoto, wasn't it?
It was, but I suppose it's all relative. If you believe the numbers or you believe what you see through the viewfinder.
No, you always only believe what you see through the viewfinder.
It's one of those things. If you've got, I mean, you will know that traditionally you would have, if you were shooting on prime lenses, on film cameras, you'd have something like a 35mm, you'd have a 50, an 85 portrait lens, a 135, a 200 maybe, and so you go up. Now,
when I was working as a press photographer, I had a 28 and an 85.
Okay.
And that's all I needed.
Okay.
Okay, if I was going out to do sports photography, I would borrow somebody's 200.
Mm.
And occasionally their 500, which was a mirror lens in those days.
Mm.
So, yeah.
But essentially, you had those on your prime lenses, those were your standard lenses.
Right.
Now, before the whole full frame
camera technology came through and people were still thinking, okay, well, there's a slight markup and what have you. Essentially, you were still thinking in terms of your, quote, standard lens was going to be, say, an 18 to 35. And then the next one that comes on from there would be something like a, if you were to have a slight gap, you'd have a 70 to 200 or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or there was a slight sort of 24 to 85. Or, you know, there's a number of varieties. I'm a great believer that it's a bit like shoe size. If someone tells you, these are a size 9, you say, well, they can't be. I'm a size 8 and these fit perfectly. It doesn't matter what the size is. It's still doing what you want it to do.
Yeah.
So, for example, if I'm thinking I want a wider lens, I will look at what the markup and conversion, how that equates. If it is a DX lens, for example, onto a non-DX body. So there's only so far I think that kind of takes you.
That makes sense then, because I only have three lenses now. Mm. I have a 10-22. I have a 17-55, and a 70-200, and that's it.
And much the same with me. And again, listeners will know that I nearly always have as my standard lens in a numerical regard, it's a 24-85, but it's an old film lens.
Yeah.
So there is a markup on there. But then I also have an 80-200, again, film lens, which on the D3 converts perfectly well. It's pretty similar. But those are my two main day-to-day lenses. I also have the lens that you're aware of, a 10-20 Sigma lens, which is my one, is lovely and sharp. I know that on your Canon, you weren't so happy with it. I seem to, maybe that was a pre-production model.
No, but another friend of mine has got a 10-20 Sigma, and he says it's like a scalpel.
Yeah.
So he's, I think that.
And is he Canon or Nikon?
It was on a Canon phone.
Oh, funny that. Yeah. But you know, at the end of the day, and again, it's. There's a certain snobbery that if you're a Canon user, you have to have the L lenses. If you're a Nikon user, you have to have the AFS lenses or the, you know, what have you. Sigma have come on leaps and bounds.
Yes,
their lenses are fantastic. If you don't mind what it says on the lens barrel, then you're fine.
Well, it's on that basis. I mean, if you're talking about a kit. The two Canon bodies I am using at the present time are two 40Ds. Mm. Now, since I bought the 40Ds, which was 3 or 4 years ago now, they produced the 50D.
Mm.
I don't think the 50D is as good as the 40D.
Mm.
The 60D, fine if you're going to produce videos, but the next jump I make will be to a 7D.
Mm.
And the only reason I'm going to do that is because I like the 17-55.
But it's interesting with the progression of camera bodies. I know in the past that you tried one of the ill-fated, wasn't it, the Mark III Canons, the 1D Mark III, which had so many problems, and let's not dwell on that because enough was made of the issues there. But it's interesting, when I was having a chat with...
Yeah, hang on that point, John. I sold that camera body, and with it, with the money I sold it on eBay, I bought three 40D bodies.
Yeah.
So I mean, and it seemed to me that I got an enormous amount of camera for very little money when I bought the 40D.
Mm.
They're brilliant.
And it, I mean, I was talking with someone on the Nikon stand at Focus on Imaging. Listeners will know, if you've listened to one of my Focus Extra shows that I put out on the Active Photographer a few weeks back, there is a something of an admission in regards to, obviously we're talking about HD video now and the SLRs having this capability, that Nikon would say, you know, their top flight cameras are the D3S, the D3X at this present time. The D3S being what a lot of professionals turn to for their video capabilities, and there's a lot of people that use them for that purpose. Now, by their own admission, they were saying that the D7000, which is current prices in this country, in the UK here, we're looking at a fraction under £900. So it's not, you know, it's nowhere near £3,500 compared to a D3S. the quality of that camera for video, by their own admission, is better than the D3S. Now, of course, that the D7000's come out later, so it benefits from technology and what have you. But it always used to be that technology filtered down from the top cameras, down the line into the prosumer, into the consumer level. But they're saying it's going the other way now.
Well, I think that's driven by the by market preference, because photographers, particularly digital photographers, have a greater knowledge, I suspect, than most amateurs did 20 years ago with film. And I think they are now matching their needs to a specific camera body, and the camera manufacturers have been forced to actually generate equipment which satisfies those needs, which is why most camera manufacturers are producing several models a year now. And if you're not careful, the amateur can very swiftly be dragged into buying the latest all-singing, all-dancing wonder. And I would like to interject to ask you a question. I have three favourite lenses. I've had those three favourite lenses for, I suppose, 6 or 7 years, and maybe a bit longer. Certainly 10 years for one of them. And I have no intention of changing them now, but I've changed the bodies several times since then. And because I don't want to buy a 7D at the moment, I have just sold one of my 40Ds on eBay, for which I got a very fair price, and I bought a second-hand 40D body, which has only made 1,900 exposures, for £300.
Wow.
So I said, you know, it saved me a fortune. I've got a very much up-to-date body, and I'm still shooting the pictures. But the pictures that I'm shooting are decided by the glass. The camera body will match what I want it to do, but it's the optical glass that's important. I think if my advice to any photographer would be, choose the lens that you need and stick to it, and then you can stick any body you like on it. That's up to the job.
That's a very valid point, isn't it? That a lot of people, the actual camera is seen as being the key piece of kit that, you know, you'd say, oh, well, I have the 40D, I have the 1DS Mark III, whatever it might be. The pictures are only going to be, much aside from all the technology and all the electrical bits and bobs in the camera body, if you've got a rubbish piece of glass, which, let's face it, what is a lens? It's a unit that focuses the light into a point through the camera that gets the crisp, sharp pictures. If you don't put emphasis on the need to have decent glass, it doesn't matter what you've got clamped on the other end of it.
Your pictures are going to be crap.
Exactly. And there was, I remember a few years ago, I was at an exhibition up at the National Portrait Gallery, and it was one called The Beautiful and the Damned, and it was all about pictures, sort of medical pictures, but sort of taken in sort of in asylums, and when they were doing the kind of electric shock treatments and all this sort of thing. Now, the actual pictures that were taken, and of course we're talking sort of glass negatives, right? They had modern silver prints made from the original glass negatives, and even by today's standards, whatever that might be, they were so sharp that it was almost unbelievable, the sharpness there. Now, some people could argue, well, the technology of sort of being able to make these modern day prints, what have you. It was the fact that you had a blooming great big negative, 10 by 8 inch negative glass plate, and the lens was... lens technology hasn't really come on huge leaps and bounds.
No.
Now, there's some audio that I will be...
You talk to most camera designers, they tell you that the limiting factor now is in the optical glass that's being produced in the lens technology, not... I don't think the number of pixels that you get onto a sensor is even remotely relevant now.
But then you look at someone like Julia Margaret Cameron, whose house you can still visit. It's a museum now down at Freshwater on the Isle of Wight. And I will actually, on the Active Photographer, I will be sharing some audio I did, an interview I did down there. her pictures, people look at them, they think, oh, they're, you know, they're all sort of soft around the edges and what have you, because that's what cameras did back then. A lot of people don't realise she physically took something that was abrasive and scratched up her lenses to get the softer softer sort of effect around the edges. If she hadn't have done that, and there are examples of some of the shots that she created that are razor sharp, because they were, she didn't touch those lenses, she left them as they were intended, you know. But so many people, and funnily enough, in the last sort of couple of weeks, I've
Other photographers achieved exactly the same thing by going around the outer edge of the lens with Vaseline.
Yeah, absolutely. And if anyone wants to try that, cheap, rather than scratching up your lenses with sandpaper, just get a cheap filter, something like a UV or a skylight filter that are cheap enough. Doesn't have to be an expensive brand, just sort of your local sort of camera shop, what have you. And or just go onto eBay and just get a cheap glass filter. And just get some Vaseline or equivalent and just smudge it around the edges of the filter, not onto the glass itself, before I start getting complaints people have ruined and gummed up all the lenses. Attach the filter, spread it around the edges on the front surface of the glass and see what the pictures turn out like, because it's a wonderful technique if you just want to play around. And you don't. It means you don't have to go into Photoshop to start putting soft focusing and Gaussian blur kind of effect. And again, I'm a great believer that if as much as you can do at the time of taking, you use what kit you've got to the best of its ability, and you don't have to do lots of tweaking in post-production. So getting back to this whole technology advancement argument, and you're the same, I know, Hugh, any amount of time that we spend in front of the computer preparing images is time
not spent taking pictures.
Not taking pictures, which means we're not earning money directly from our camera out and about.
In a sense, I think that, of course, there are still printers. But I think most photographers are now producing their own images. And even if they're actually passing the actual physical printing out to a lab, they're doing all the post-production. They're passing the printer a disc of images which, so far as they're concerned, are finished.
Mm.
So today's photographer is doing far more work than his predecessor, actually.
Mm. Mm.
And although most people would disagree with me, I think he knows far more about photography than he did.
Mm.
And just shoved the button. And certainly some of the girls that I used to know who were shooting portraits other times didn't really understand photography at all.
Mm.
They relied entirely on pushing the button to get the right picture, and then they relied on the printer to get the best they could out of the negative.
Mm. And it's interesting. I've lost my train of thought. I was hearing the front your front door going, but it is interesting that there is this emphasis on technology. So when people are saying, what camera should I buy, for example, someone said to me the other day, I have £500 to buy a camera and a lens. Well, there are packages that are £450 and they'll do the job. But if someone had £1,000, or okay, let's say someone said had £1,200 to buy a camera, which they're an enthusiast, they're not going to be giving it, you know, lots of use except for maybe at weekends, you'd be better off spending, depends on the lens that you're wanting to get.
As far as I was concerned, Giles, if that was us, I'd say you buy Canon or Nikon,
mm-hmm.
you go to a Canon user or you go to a Nikon user and then say, what are you using and why?
Mm.
You get them to give you some sort of advice, and you start off with one body and one lens, and you learn how to use that body and that lens. And I don't think I'd buy new at all.
No.
I would actually talk to that guy and say, what really good body should I buy, which will get me through the first initial stages of my photography?
And I think it's maybe worth mentioning from our own perspectives. I went to digital. Actually, I was quite a late starter with the switch to digital, But that said, I went to digital before you did, and you watched all the trials and errors
You talked me into it.
I talked you into it at a point where you were ready to be convinced.
Yeah, that's true.
I think is the fair way to put it. And you know, between us, you saw the shots I was producing, and you were asking lots of questions, as I would expect. But what sealed the deal for me was, I won't give the full story because it wouldn't be fair. Should we say it wouldn't be fair on canon? But my reasons were specific as to why I went to Nikon, apart from the camera that they had at the time that suited me. That decision was the fact that the budget that I had, the camera that was at that price point, which was the D100 at the time, did what I wanted it to do. I was convinced of the quality of the pictures at that point, and that's what made me decide. But one of the interesting things...
Yeah, but you also had some Nikon lenses too, didn't you?
No, I didn't.
I was
a Pentax user. When I shot film, I was shooting on Pentax film cameras. But the thing that was a real surprise for me, much aside from the JPEG versus RAW debate, which that's another topic for another longer conversation, another day perhaps. But I remember doing some tests. You and I both use fill-in flash technique a lot for wedding photography, social photography, all those sort of areas. I had my flash gun, I had my camera, it was a D100 with a 17 to 80 or 17 to 85 mm lens or something like that. And I set it and I thought, well, I'm going to dial the flash in to be sort of quarter power, which is fairly typical, you know, a bit of fill light. And I set it up as I had done with my flash, with my film cameras, and I pressed the shutter release, and the whole picture just blew out. It was like I was photographing a piece of white paper. There was nothing on there, and I was thinking, why has it done? And I was looking, I was thinking, there's the camera set up right. I haven't changed it, and it was very clear, very quickly, that there was this switch, that this crossover where all of a sudden what I knew and trusted with film didn't necessarily always apply.
Well, it hardly ever did apply. No. In fact, all sorts of things used to go wrong, didn't they?
Yeah, and this is where you just sat there with a wry smile on your face watching my results. And I remember times when we both went over to the print lab that we were using and said, look, why is this happening? And they're saying, well, look, you know, we can run more print tests for you. And there's nothing wrong with their printing. It was fine.
Yeah.
But it was everything from colour spaces to file formats to... Because it was all new.
The thing that really threw me most of all in those early days was the depth of field, which didn't seem to bear any relationship to aperture or shutter speed.
Because you did tests on your local playing fields, didn't you, with broom handles with signs put on them saying 10 metres, 20 metres, what have you.
It didn't make any difference. extraordinary level. I mean, the what we used to call the zone of acceptable sharpness was enormous. And it seemed to me that you couldn't make any mistakes.
I mean, that's an interesting point because I could see some instances where there was a slight differential and you could physically see the difference. But maybe it was something, had you spoken to anyone else that was either both a Canon user or a Nikon user who'd found the same thing? Because I didn't see that with my Nikon lenses and Nikon cameras.
Everybody that I talk to, it's a bit like you talk to people and say, have you read Salman Rushdie's Satanic Verses? I've never yet met anybody who honestly said they read the whole book all the way through. I have read it several times, or started to read it several times, never been able to finish it. It's a wonderful book, I'm certain. It's just it's not the sort of book that I want to talk about. So far as photography is concerned, I think most people are going to tell the story that they actually want to believe themselves. And no one is going to admit that the purchase that they made is less than satisfactory, or that they may have made a mistake. And certainly professional photographers are not going to admit that they don't understand what they're talking about. When was it? Do you remember when we went to that wonderful Kodak demonstration up in Hemstead?
Oh, Hemstead, yeah.
When the Jap stood up and said, with a huge grin on his face, "You put P on a digital camera and we know it stands for professional."
Yeah. That was a very interesting day. The one thing that, in hindsight, you now think the bugger, he was actually right, is when he stood there and very blatantly said, "Look, by the end of today, you will be convinced that you need to shoot RAW." So we were convinced, but we still shot JPEG. And frankly, unless you're blowing the pictures up really big, most people are not going to know the difference.
Of course, my magnificent 40D Canon cameras shoot RAW and JPEG simultaneously.
Yeah, and the same with the Nikons. How often do you actually do that, though? Or did you only ever really do that? Because I think maybe you're...
Whenever I'm shooting a wedding, I do it.
Okay.
And the reason I do it is because I can get my preview albums out far faster because I don't have to bother to do the RAW. So I preview on JPEG and I actually produce the images that they want in their album by actually manipulating the RAW files that they've selected.
Mm. See, that makes a lot of sense. And then just as another example for myself, if I'm shooting, say, at an event where I am working with a journalist and he's writing the copy for the live updates on the website, I can then be shooting simultaneously RAW files and JPEGs, sort of small JPEGs, which we don't have time to edit the pictures. They're literally straight out of the camera. I can give him the card that has the JPEGs on, and he can just pick out the small JPEGs ready for the website. The RAW files then stay there, backed up at the end of the night, which then are ready to be supplied to go into whatever file system it may be, whether it's picture libraries or what have you. They're, so you've got the best of both worlds.
Well, I use my small JPEGs often to produce the preview album, but also to put them up on the website so that the couple can look at their wedding pictures on honeymoon.
And so those particular JPEGs, do you resize those? Because there's, as a reference for you guys, there's some software called PhotoRaiser, which we've both used for a long time. And I still use it if I'm doing stuff that needs to go up. If I've got a batch of pictures.
It doesn't actually do more than 300 pictures in one go.
Right.
Otherwise, I've discovered.
So do you use it up to the point that you have 300 pictures? Do you still use it?
All my photographic albums are remarkably just under 300 pictures.
That's very clever. So you still use that software?
Oh yeah.
And it's a piece of free software.
That's right. Yeah.
And they once you kind of register your interest with it, they send you an email to say here's an update and what have you. But again, you know, professional photographers using a bit of free software that is not Photoshop, that does not cost you £800-900 for a suite of software.
Yeah, but I'm with the same argument. I am shooting most of my pictures on a lens which costs less than £700.
Mm.
Where many so-called professional photographers and many wealthy amateurs will say, "Phew, it's not an L series lens, is it?" Well, it isn't. But it's still better than any other lens I've ever come across.
Yeah.
And I think it comes down to whatever suits you, and providing it does the job, why not?
I think it's a bit like...
I drink red wine with chicken too.
I think it's a bit... Yeah. I think it's a bit like manufacturers of cars. You know, every now and then, you hear this throughout the years, they produce a car or a model of a car where not a lot was made of it, but it was the absolute jewel of that year or that series. That it was almost like the best kept secret. You can pick them up relatively cheap or what have you, and they had the best engine, they had the best, what's considered to be the best suspension setup, whatever it might be. And as long as you don't mind saying to someone, "Oh yeah, I've got this one," for those that know, it's a bit like the 50mm Nikon lens. Yeah. It's fantastic.
For years and years and years, I drove a Saab 900 16 valve turbo.
Mm.
And I drove it till my wife refused to get into it anymore.
That's the one that she referred to as the tank.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant car. Yeah, nothing ever went wrong with it.
Mm.
And it outperformed nearly everything else on the road. Mm. It just that, no, she actually, it was getting so shabby that she wouldn't get into it anymore. I have noticed, however, that the front of your Fiat is now looking somewhat dented.
And that is of no fault of my own. I have actually witnessed people reversing across the road into my car.
Well, deliberately, they say, oh, we give him another bump.
Yeah. Well, it's incredible. I used to live at a place where the only parking was in a public car park. And I was there for a good amount of time and never did I once have a scratch or dent. The moment I moved to a more quiet residential area, funnily enough, people, there were more scratches there every week. But we digress. My reference to cars, I'm not a car person, you know that. But just, yeah, getting back to the whole technology thing, we should probably kind of round up our thoughts on this.
It's a bit like wine, Giles. I think you should use what you like and what does the job for you. Just the same way as you should choose the wine that you like, not because what people expect you to drink it.
And that, I think we'll leave it there because I probably couldn't have said it better myself. That's it.
What are your thoughts about the ongoing changes we see within the photography world? As ever, do let me know. You can check out all the show notes to this and other week's shows at theactivephotographer.com. If you'd like to get in touch directly, don't forget, I'm on Twitter, at Giles Babbage. You can check out The Active Photographer Facebook page, facebook.com/TheActiveFotographer. Or, of course, send me a good old-fashioned email, giles@TheActiveFotographer.com. So thanks for listening, everyone. Take care, have a great week, and I will speak to you all very soon.